It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for joining us. James Magruder began his professional life in the theater. He received his doctorate in dramaturgy and dramatic criticism from Yale University and has successfully translated and adapted plays by Molière and many others. He's also written his own plays as well and continues teaching dramaturgy at Swarthmore College. But Magruder is also a novelist and a short story writer, and that's the hat he's wearing today. His collection of linked stories, Let Me See It, has been out for about 6 weeks. It tells the intertwined stories of Tom and Elliot, cousins who are both gay and who are navigating growing up in the 1970s and 80s. That Tom and Elliot bear some small resemblance to their author is no accident. Magruder was in Milwaukee last week to read from Let Me See It at Boswell Book Company, and he stopped by the Lake Effect studio to chat with me first. James, welcome to Lake Effect. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me, Bonnie.
I enjoyed Let Me See It very, very much. I think we came up of an age at the same time, and I was recognizing these folks and these cousins that you've built the book around. Where did they come from? Are they people you knew? Is it based on people you knew?
As with my first novel, this is very, very autobiographical. I took up fiction fairly late, 10 years ago in my early 40s. I think I needed enough time and or distance on like some poor choices I made in my early 20s, generally with older men. So I started writing, and then basically these are all the stories I've written, and you could say that it's me with a different college major. So when I was trying to shop them around as a collection to sell, a few editors said, these should be linked. And I said, okay, but I wasn't sure how to do it. And then I hit upon – because there are some differences, important sort of differences that emerged in the story. And I realized that having two cousins who almost never see each other, I in a way split my personality because I, like one of my two heroes, should have died in 1991. I was down to like almost no T cells, but then I was one of those combination therapy miracles by the late 90s. So there's a part of me that has survivor's guilt. So there's the part of me that was reckless and then the part of me that's very careful. So that's kind of where they're based on. And then in the end, they took on their own life.
Yeah, they really did because as I was interested in how they developed over the stories because, as you said, they're linked stories. It kind of reads as a novel, but they can stand alone, each piece. And Tom and Elliot are the two heroes and the two parts of you, the two cousins, who I love that they never met until they were 25. And we never find out the mystery of why there was a division in the family.
Right.
And we just sort of assume something bad happened with the uncle and the mother. Did I get that right? Was it Tom's uncle and Elliot's aunt?
Yeah. Tom's mother and Elliot's father are siblings.
Are siblings, yeah. Right. I thought I had figured that out. I'm intrigued by what you said about making bad choices and the survivor's guilt. One of the things I loved about the stories is that I didn't feel that you were making excuses for any of the behavior. It's simply, this is the story of these two people, and this is how they lived their lives. And I loved that. To me, it was very refreshing.
Oh, thanks. And, you know, the thing that distinguishes it, say, from a novel is that, again, these are my apprenticeship stories in a way. So I was, I knew that any collection of stories, you had to do first person, you had to have some third person stories. And for years, I couldn't get arrested in the third person because coming from the theater, you know, a play is like a competing landscape of first person voices. So I would never say I could whip off a story, but first person came much more easily to me. But in building them together, I think having sort of an outside narrator watching them versus there are a couple times when Tom will narrate a story and likewise Elliot, I think that gives it a variety. And then with those outside narrators, they're not there to judge.
No, yeah. And I never felt that they did.
Yeah.
And I really like that because it's so many coming-of-age stories will have that tinge, you know, of like, oh, well, you know, they were bad or they did. It's like, no, we all make these kinds of mistakes.
Yes.
And some of us pay more dearly than others. Theater, of course, is such a huge part of your life, and it plays a part in the lives of your characters as well. Some directly, like Tom goes and actually works at the Madison Rep, or what was the Madison Rep. And you spent time there, right?
Actually, I had to – in putting the stories together, that story, Mistress of the Revels, is originally set in Baltimore, where I had been the resident dramaturg at Center Stage, which is kind of the Milwaukee rep of Baltimore, for years and years and years. But I teach at Swarthmore College, and my chair there in the theater department is from Wisconsin. And I just called him up one night and said, I have to move this to Madison. Give me some markers. And and doing the research, I said, did you see that there was a Madison stage company that may or may not have been doing, you know, Pericles in, you know, 1985. But yeah, I sort of grafted Madison onto Baltimore.
What made you move from theater and from writing plays and being a dramaturg to writing fiction? What was the compulsion?
Well, I'd always wanted to write fiction. And I think in the life of any, you know, putative artist, especially writers, you have to give yourself permission to be an artist or to be a writer. And that can take some people 6 months. It can take some people 20 years. And really, it was after, again, I don't want to flog this horse, but it was after my immune system recovered in 1996, where I thought, well, you know, actually, because I was supposed to die, I thought, well, I should fulfill that early promise. And I was at the McDowell Colony in New Hampshire in 2001, and I'd finished a draft of – I was there at a playwriting residency. I finished a draft of the play early. I had a week left. And so what I did instead of going home early or going swimming is that I – attempted a piece of prose, a piece of fiction. And whether that's good or not, by the end of that week, I had such a good time with it, it suggested other stories. So when I got back to Baltimore, for the next few years, I alternated chapters of my first novel, these stories, and then translation gigs. So I was kind of doing it all at once. And over time, I've gotten a clearer signal from the world of fiction that this is what I should be doing. So, and I don't have so many ideas for plays anymore, but I love collaboration.
Speaking in terms of craft now, how is telling a story in a play different for you than telling a story in, say, a novella or a short story?
Well, it's much easier. You know that cliche, well, I just sit at the laptop and the voices start talking. That's actually true. There are some things in fiction. I think fiction is much harder, at least for me, because there are certain things that theater takes care of that you, the writer, doesn't have to. So I don't have to say that in a play her narrow face was framed by chestnut curls. You know, the actress, whoever your cast does that. You don't have to do the sentences that I just can't – well, it's not that you have to write them sometimes, basically blocking. She crossed the room and opened the door. That is no fun to write as a sentence, but you need that sort of ligature that, you know, you don't have – the director figures that out. And then there's the interior monologues, you know, or the interior thoughts in a novel or a story. Well, unless you're writing monologues for the stage, you don't have to do that. It's just dialogue and things you do. So and a much more compressed span of time. You know, I'm always aware of trying to stay ahead of my reader.
One of the things, of course, that frames this whole collection is the AIDS crisis and what was happening from basically 1981 until 1991 when this particular set of stories ends. And this may be my age showing, but, you know, I think what it must be like for people who were this age in their teens and into their 20s now who have never not lived with that specter and never not had to worry about it and never not had to think about it, because I think you and I grew up at a time when you didn't.
Exactly.
And I wonder who these people might be if they had not had to worry about that.
Yes, that's a great observation. I was actually walking to the studio. I thought, if I were born in 1962 instead of 1960, by the time the HIV was identified as a virus, I'd be safe. I would have always been practicing safe sex. I'm in this, just 2 years and I'd have been fine. And I am fine, but so many people didn't survive. But, you know, younger people today are mistakenly assume that it's a treatable disease. It's very treatable, but it's mutating. So you just got to be careful.
Well, yeah, it's not over. It's not, yeah, it's not smallpox.
It's not by any stretch of the imagination.
It still confines generations in ways that other things define maybe our generation and the generation before us. This continues to play a role even if we aren't like as hyper aware of it as we were in the 80s and early 90s when things were so awful. We somehow have put it aside for other awful things, or because there is treatment that works for some people, we don't worry about it as much? I'm
right.
not sure. You
yeah,
know,
I don't know what the mind – but you know, when you're young, you're 18 or 19, you think you're invincible.
You
live
invincible.
Forever.
Yeah.
You don't see the anvil hanging over your head. But I do. I often say that to my students. The older I get, just the more acutely aware I become of the passage of time. You know, we're just rolling downhill at this point in my, you know, in my 50s. It's like it's going to be over so fast.
Before we even blink.
Yeah.
Tom and Elliot, you're sort of doppelgangers, kind of, sort of. Would you want to spend time with them now?
I think – you mean –
like if they existed.
If they existed, yeah. Yes. Because I've – you know, the book's been out 5 or 6 weeks and – readers have reached out to me and said, I knew people like this, or I know people like this, or this reminds me. The last story in the book, that was when I had to create, when I decided to link them, it has to sort of culminate in everything and all this, the strands have to come together. That's completely invented. And I had a really good time. And I feel a little proud of myself because I always say, Jim, someday you're going to actually start making shit up instead of just drawing into the autobiographical well. So I think I would have a good time with them. I mean, I'd find Elliot sort of exasperating, and Tom might be a little dull, but, you know.
I was thinking a little sort of not stodgy. He's not stodgy exactly, but he's very purposeful.
Yes. If I try to jam them all together as one person, something would be lost. And in the end, I must have in a very preconscious way knew that I needed to address my survivor's guilt and acknowledge that there's a part of me that should have died. There's a part of me that's ashamed that he got the virus. And yet that's also insane.
Well, and Tom kind of – he takes that on for you.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got survivor's guilt without ever having
– been tested.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I like the fact – I don't want to give too much mm-hmm. away, but you sort of leave some of that hanging at the end. You don't really wrap it all up
no.
for us.
No.
Will we be visiting them again, do you think? Are there more stories to tell?
Oh, there's so many more. Somebody asked me that in Charlottesville, and I said, well, actually there are bits along the way, but that would seem very funny, like another set of Link stories where you know the outcome. Yeah, there are so many. There are other bad, poor choices I made as a young man that are worth some investigation, I think.
Well, I was thinking just Tom and Elliot, let's meet them again, mm-hmm. you know, at some future yeah. date, just because they're so interesting. One of the things I really loved about the way it all came together was when they finally get to know each other and they finally start to talk to each other, even though there's like gaps of time mm-hmm. and all of that, they kind of help each other learn about life in a way that's very, very interesting and very, very poignant.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I'd say I do the funny, sad thing. It's very kind of gay characteristic. I mean, there are lots of very funny moments in the book. But as I was writing these stories singularly one at a time and getting them published in journals, my closest group of friends, the people who know me the longest, everyone else would say, oh, God, that story, it's your funniest yet. And then two friends of mine in particular, like, that is your saddest story yet.
The same one.
The exact same story, yeah. But the different reactions. And I think the people who know me most or have known me longest say, understand the sadness.
Well, and the humor. And they again, like Tom and Elliot, they go together. They really don't exist without each other. So what are you working on next? Now that this has been out and you're doing the tour?
Oddly enough, I've written a new play that I just spent the first half of June workshopping at the Kenyon Playwrights Conference. And it's about – well, actually, I almost don't want to say it because it is such a broad satirical target that no one has chosen to hit yet.
Okay.
That if I actually tell you, then
somebody will grab it.
Yeah, somebody will grab it. So I'll tell you that after we're off. But there's this other novel that I've written that I'm trying to sell. It's called Love Slaves of Helen Hadley Hall, and that treats my first year of graduate school at Yale when it was the year that the virus was identified as such. So it's a more overtly comic book than my other two. Anyway, so I'm working on that, and I'm also trying to work on a book of novellas set in a summer stock theater where I had so much fun as a young man.
That one I'm really looking forward to because, as we talked about before, I also spent summers working mm-hmm. in summer stock theater as a young woman, and it was – I have very fond memories.
It's a great time.
And also did some good theater too,
yeah.
But that was the
– Right. That was the gravy, yes.
That was the least of it. So I'm hoping that you will read us a little something before you go. And if I can implore you to read something that has to do with Wisconsin.
Yes. This is the opening of Mistress of the Revels. It's set in 1984. Shakespeare had brought them together, and Shakespeare would drive them apart. Tom Emilio, a new hire at the Madison Stage Company, had spent his first weeks as communications assistant tracking down face painters and Chippewa storytellers for the theater's annual open house. Then came his first real challenge, writing a press release for the upcoming production of Pericles. Its hopscotching plot was difficult to summarize. His boss pointed him to education director Lucy Hacks, who had paused halfway through her doctorate at the University of Wisconsin on women in Greek drama to, as she liked to say, bring the magic of live theater to the underserved. Lucy had been most helpful in their ad hoc meeting, providing him with the snappy technical term prose romance and insisting on the inclusion of swashbuckling in his lead paragraph, so Tom invited her to lunch. Of the many intriguing notions she revealed him in the noisy pub she chose at the edge of campus, perhaps the oddest was that a woman needed extra iron at a certain time every month. This after she had appended a throaty, very rare, to her cheeseburger order. Like satin teddies and seed pearl clips, Lucy wouldn't dream of piercing her ears, a platter of red meat, she said, was another way to celebrate her femininity. Tom nodded sagely, although he knew that his mother and aunts didn't believe in womanly treats. He smiled to imagine them with him, listening to this East Coast career girl, blonde and very petite, but fluent in big ideas like performance art and diaspora studies. As they waited for their food, Lucy interrupted the story of her life with racy assessments of select undergraduates at neighboring tables. The shoulders on this one meant swim team. This other, pulling snarls of onion rings out of a red-webbed basket, had fingers she wanted to bite. The one in the takeout line with a lacrosse butt was definitely worth a nasty. A nasty? Asked Tom, new to the term. As in doing the nasty. Is that Shakespeare? No, silly, it's Black English. As in I love doing the nasty. She giggled. And I do. This was a voguish declaration, especially for a white girl from Connecticut, with four younger siblings who lined up along the staircase on Christmas morning according to age, like the five little Peppers.
James Magruder, it has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
James Magruder is the author of the Link Story Collection, Let Me See It. He's also a playwright and dramaturg and teaches at Swarthmore College and at the University of Baltimore. Magruder read from his book last week at Boswell Book Company, and he stopped by the studio to chat with us then. And that wraps up our show today. I'm Bonnie North, thanking you again, as always, for tuning in. We're looking forward to having you join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.